I'm Michael Heyman, and you're listening to Changemakers. Joining me today is Marion Medin, founder of The Soak, a new mental health concept integrating mental health care, well-being, support, and performance coaching. Launched last year at the height of the pandemic, Marion has seen firsthand the impact of COVID disruption on workplace well-being, both the good and the bad. From the isolation of lockdown to the newfound flexibility of remote working, Marion has helped to identify the challenges and opportunity that come from our new normal, while working to shift the narrative from it's okay to talk to it's healthy to talk. With the values of responsibility, integrity, and creativity at the heart of her business, and an extraordinary story of personal challenges that come from fleeing war-torn Iran to come to the UK as a child, this is the story of a founder with a view on what it takes to make a better life, both for yourself and critically for those around you. Marion, welcome to Changemakers. Marion, a very warm welcome to Changemakers.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Oh, a real pleasure to interview you, and what an amazing story we're going to be able to share in this episode, I'm sure. Now, in terms of framing your extraordinary life, I mean, from fleeing Iran to growing up in the UK to building a fabulous new initiative called The Soak, all of which we're going to talk about, I think to get us started, I'd like to start with your quote for life, because I suppose it's in saying, you know, those things about your journey that it makes a little sense about try to learn a little about everything. Tell us about why you've suggested that, and I guess crucially, what it means to you personally.
Well, I mean, my personal journey, my professional journey, I should say, has got a little bit of law and a little bit of branding and a little bit of mental health, and now a big bit of mental health. And I'm already thinking, what am I going to do next? So I've really adopted that philosophy of trying to learn a little bit about everything and being interested in a little bit about everything. And I've been lucky to have a rich and varied life with the opportunity to pursue things that are of interest to me. My father was quite eccentric in that sense. He always used to give us really sort of sweeping bits of mad advice.
Didn't I have seem a sense to my have... daughter might be saying this in about 20 years' time in an interview.
Well, it sort of seemed to be out of touch with what real life was all about. So as I've mentioned also in sort of the quote.
Why was he out of touch, do you think? What was his
background?
He
was a dreamer. He was a dreamer. And he really sort of had big ideas, big dreamy ambitions. It wasn't about sort of professional success, or it was about changing the world. It was doing extraordinary things. And this was, you know, he the advice he used to give was, you know, you should be able to sit next to a king or a street sweeper, and you should be able to engage with them in conversation on an equal level, whichever it is. It did seem quite lofty then, and it seems quite lofty now, but it served me well, because I do try to be interested and learn a little bit about it. It served me very, very well, actually.
I mean, I suppose when you learn a little bit about everything as well, as it kind of means you've got to be very situationally aware. It's not just about reading books. It's about having empathy. It's about noticing things in people's lives. I mean, a little bit about everything can often sound, well, what is that? Well, it's actually quite a lot, I think, when you think about what it means to live life that way.
Yeah, you have to pay attention. You have to be a good listener. I'm also a very good talker. So I sort of try to remind myself from time to time to just shut up and listen. It is about trying to learn and understand. And as you say, have this sense of empathy. And I think that if you have had a mixed bag of experiences over your life, some of those skills do tend to come more naturally than if you have led a life in which you can afford to be oblivious to what's around you. So I would say that I've had a little bit of a push.
I want to get into some of those, I suppose, core chapters in a moment. But I was reading a magazine article that you contributed to recently where you said that the most important values to see your business through adversity are responsibility, integrity, and creativity. Let's take an angle on why those three are so core to you.
Certainly responsibility, I think, is something that I felt from a very early age, partly due to family circumstances, and my parents were both emotionally vulnerable people. And therefore, I felt the weight of responsibility of looking after their emotions and other members of our family. It was something that meant a great deal to me from a very early age. I had to watch my words. I had to have considered responses and to understand that my actions would impact other people from, I'm going to say, as far back as 5 or 6. And I sort of understood that as I went through life, different situations gave cause to different weights of responsibility. After a while, it became about people trusting me and propelling me to do something good with my life, putting their faith in me, being generous with what they could do. And that comes with responsibility. When people are going out of their way to help you, then you have to adopt that.
So when you talk about the 5 or 6 year old, presumably this is the 5 or 6 year old newly arrived from Iran as a refugee in the UK with a whole new life being built by your parents in a country that they had probably never intended to live in the first place. I mean, how does that shape the conditions of, well, I suppose it has shaped a lot of what you've said in terms of the careful consideration and things, but in terms of how that affected you, the person, and your outlook, either positively or negatively, give us a sense of actually, I guess, that very important part of that early story in your life, Marion.
I'm very flattered that you think I was 5 or 6 after the revolution. I'm afraid I was a little bit older than that. I actually came to school here when I was 5. I came to boarding school here when I was 5. My parents lived in Iran. My brothers and I were sent abroad. Life was all quite blessed and free from adversity until the Iranian Revolution in 1979. And I then went to Iran in 1981 for what was supposed to be a brief holiday and ended up getting stuck there for nearly 4 years. So when I came back, the point at which I did have to apply for asylum, I was by this stage about 15. My parents stayed in Iran. They had by this stage lost everything. And my mother effectively gave me a £10 note and said, this is now the last thing I have to give you. You're on your own.
That must have been extraordinary. I mean, you say it so calmly, but I mean, in terms of the turning of your world upside down.
Yeah, it was. I had spent the last sort of three and a half years in Iran saying to my parents, you've got to get me back to the UK. You've got to get me back. And they kept saying, we've got nothing to give you. What are we going to do? Just sort of dump you there. And I was like, yes, that's all I need. Just get me back and I will do the rest. And it was a case of be careful what you wish for, because that is exactly what they did. And my mother left me at Heathrow saying, here you are, here's the last £10 I have in the world. And the only thing I ask is that you keep the promise that you gave, which was to try to make something of yourself.
A very recent moment like Afghanistan, where many people are here in the UK in ways that they probably never dreamt of. How does that make you feel? Is it a sense of deja vu, or do you think things have changed between then and now?
No, I it feels very, very different to my experience. I arrived at a time when I was welcomed, I was supported. I was interesting. I was an interesting story. Everybody was generous and kind towards me. And at the risk of sort of, you know, sounding a bit pompous, this is the result. I am now a woman who is able to run a business, has done plenty of good things for the society in which I live over the years. I've contributed. I've tried to play my part. And I think what we now have is this image of refugees as being a drain on society. And in fact, my personal experience and those of whom I know are all people who say, give us a chance. We want to, I mean, there's nothing better than an economic refugee, frankly, because they're the people who are pursuing opportunity and a good life and want to do something remarkable.
I read that you said, I believe, Cecilia, that you'll not get more hardworking, dedicated, committed employees than people who have risked life and limb to create a better life for themselves and their families. I mean, you know, when you think about the role of migration and great societies, I mean, that free movement of people seems to be a very common part of the stories of some of the greatest cities and countries the world has seen, I guess.
Yeah, there isn't a shadow of doubt in my mind that those are the people who are hungry and desperate to prove themselves far beyond anything that somebody who feels a sense of entitlement to where they live will do. I mean, I've now been a British citizen for, I think, 25 years or so. Mm. And I haven't been born here, but I've been raised here largely. And I'm still conscious that I must make my hosts feel welcome, even though I feel very much a sense of ownership over London, certainly.
I was going to say, because I mean, you use the word host. I mean, that's an interesting one. I mean, do you feel home in Britain and in London?
I feel very much at home in London. But I am also conscious that I came here as a guest and I stayed. I overstayed my welcome. And now
You've stayed your welcome by the sounds of it.
I've now got to prove that it was the investment that this country made in me was worthwhile. And actually, what may be a particularly relevant point in my life story is that I applied for political asylum and I was refused. Mm. But I was given something that was called exceptional leave to remain, which loosely translated is like saying, well, we don't believe you. We don't think your life is in danger if you go back home. However, we're prepared to take a chance that you might be worth keeping. And that leaves its mark on you. You know, spend the rest of your life thinking, okay, they took a punt. I'd better prove them right.
Well, you better prove them right. And I suppose in your own mind as well, this kind of extraordinary love of knowledge and the idea about learning that little bit about everything. And I suppose it explains some of the building blocks. Now, you've mentioned how, I guess, family played such a formative part in your story and that you spent a lot of time in a responsible role. Now, very, very sadly, you recently lost your mother, which obviously I know we would want to express our condolences on, but that you had spent a large amount of your adult life caring for your mum. I mean, tell us a bit about that and I guess the effect that it had on you in terms of how you tended to look at things.
I'm actually going to rewind to a story about my father that I think was life-changing for me. I was about 13 or 14. This is when I was living in Iran post-revolution. For some very bizarre reason, some years before, my father's eldest brother, in the way that bizarre Middle Eastern rituals go, had decided that he would buy a giant plot in a cemetery for all the members of the family. So he had literally counted his brothers and sisters and their offspring and their spouses and thought, right, here are 30 graves right next to each other. Fast forward the Iran-Iraq war, and suddenly the price of these graves shot up because there were just so many war dead. And my father was absolutely destitute. He had lost everything. He had not a penny to his name. And in his infinite wisdom, decided to go to his eldest brother and say, could I have my grave, please? And his brother said, no, you can't. This is for the family. And there then followed a huge family row about my father wanting his grave and my uncle not being prepared to give it to him. The reason which my uncle gave was, well, because then there are going to be sort of 10 members of the family, a complete stranger, another 10 members of the family, a complete stranger, and so on. And my father told me this story, and the two of us were howling with laughter and crying at the same time at just the surrealness of the whole thing, of my father saying, give me my grave, my uncle saying no, because we don't want a stranger to be buried among us. And my father saying, I don't care where I'm buried, just leave me on the street. Now, the tragedy and the comedy in that at the same time stayed with me and stay with me still as a pinnacle moment in my life of sort of understanding human emotion and how complex it is and how tragedy is mixed with comedy. And also, actually, in that moment, I think I realized there will never be anything in my life. I'm not saying I laugh at other people's lives, but nothing in my life that will be too tragic for me to laugh about. And that's shaped everything that I have lived through.
Well, and I suppose it shapes your sense of resilience, but does it also, I mean, you know, because this is a unique set of, you know, I suppose family experiences and, mm-hmm. and the, you know, the outcome of which is last year you launched the SOAC, which is a new mental health concept, bringing healthcare, well-being, support and performance coaching. What I'm wondering is the degree, and I want to talk about the SOAC in a bit more detail, but in terms of what gets you there, do you think that sort of that strand of caring that I guess, and family that is such a big part of your hinterland, certainly as it comes across in this interview. I mean, is that what we should take from it in terms of the formative thinking, the thing that gets to the Mariam of today, I guess?
I think that it's an interesting question because I feel to some extent that I am here despite not having that sort of family, the scaffolding of family to some extent that I could sort of climb up. And what I've discovered and what's kind of brought me here is this sense of collaboration. So many different people in my life have played a role. Even today, I would say that I look back on my life and I look at the various sort of decades or, you know, little chunks of years. And I remember people. I can relate it. I can say, well, that was the period in my life when so-and-so was helping me. And that was the period that so-and-so was helping me. And it sort of feels as if I was some sort of, you know, symbolic baton in a relay of human kindness because people just kept passing me on and on and on. What would have happened to me if I hadn't had those people? I don't know. I don't believe that I single-handedly would have got myself here. It was absolutely this sense of being able to rely on others and rely on that.
I mean, what a beautiful phrase, a baton in the relay of human kindness. I mean, there's such lyricism to that. I mean, and I think, you know, goes so far in explaining, I guess, your outlook, Mariam. I mean, tell us a little bit about the SOAC. It comes across when you read about it that this is very much your life, your passion project, something that has phenomenal potential to make a really big difference. Let's introduce people to what you're doing.
I mean, the reason I arrived here to some extent was because I woke up having measured my life or my life success by the financial results. I ran a branding company and from one year to the next, I could only say if I was doing well and whether I'd arrived at my destination if the numbers were good. And it just didn't feel very satisfying. So I wanted to have a new way by which to measure my own achievements and sort of my life. And so there was something meaningful that I wanted to do and something that I was very interested in for various reasons that we've already touched on from my background.
And may I just ask, in that environment, were you aware of the mental health challenges for people around you in terms of that must deliver growth culture?
I was fortunate enough to be in a position where about 10 or 12 years ago, I was able to take one day off from work and pursue something that I was interested in. And that was training as a psychotherapist. And having come from a commercial background, and a commercial background in which what I did was very much sort of focused on service, I suddenly thought, my God, there is a huge void here. And there is all this conversation. As the years passed, the conversation continued about, you know, the importance of destigmatization and how we should all feel sort of completely comfortable to talk about our mental health and so on. But actually, when people came to experience it, if they tried to pursue some sort of mental health care, the experience was very, very different to what they'd heard. So you still were treated to some extent as if you had an illness rather than something that was a common situation that we all experience. I think the ups and downs of sort of emotional well-being fluctuate in all of us. So the experience was very different. It was quite clinical. There was no service. There wasn't a single touch point between you as the user and the delivery. So you walk up to the door of the therapy, open the door, your therapy starts there. What happens in between that sort of moment when you think, I think I need some help, and walking in through the therapy door? Nothing. This was what was going on, nothing.
So in terms of the concept, I mean, was there a moment in time where you thought, I've got an idea here? Or was this just a sort of learning process over a period of time and a set of experiences?
The sort of eureka moment was actually when I was studying psychotherapy, and I remember turning to a couple of friends who in fact now work at the SOAC and saying, I think things should be done differently. And then I went off, I went back to my, I worked as a psychotherapist for a little while on a part-time basis in a refugee center. And then I went back to my branding life, and all as the years passed, I kept seeing the conversation sort of explode about mental health care. And I was still getting calls from friends saying, my experience has been XYZ. I don't want to carry on. I don't want to take my child to see somebody because I'm afraid that they'll self-diagnose or self-stigmatize. So I just thought it's about time somebody did something. And since nobody else was doing it, that was my opportunity.
And how has the pandemic impacted the SOAC? I mean, obviously, a lot of your early phase has coincided with our experience of the pandemic in terms of how it's affected the concept and how you see it going from here. Tell us a little bit about that.
I don't think that the pandemic has really made a difference to us as a business. The only way in which it's been noticeable is that we expected to have a lot of preaching to do to corporates. We always thought that we would like to work with big organizations and tell them about the importance of mental health alongside physical health. And that's been something that we haven't had to do. They're approaching us now and saying, help us create that thing that makes our employees feel safe and happy and so on. But in terms of whether or not, you know, we've seen a sudden sort of deluge of clients who are coming in because of the pandemic, I wouldn't say that's the case at all. We have seen an upturn in younger people, but funnily enough, that was not when sort of isolation and so on was at its peak. It was when people had to go back to school and back to work that the problem reared its ugly head.
I mean, a lot of people talk about mental health as the new pandemic. I think you mentioned something very interesting there about the changing attitude of leaders to it in terms of, I guess, it speaks to a broader corporate consciousness, a responsibility. In terms of what's driving it, do you get a sense that where has the awareness among leaders come from in terms of those that you're talking to that are now saying, well, actually, we didn't do something then, but we are now very committed to doing something now?
I think that the response or the responsibility of leaders to their employees has always been fairly uniform. And what happened with the pandemic was that suddenly they had a workforce where there might be five different, wildly different responses or experiences of exactly the same thing. So we all experienced the pandemic in our own way, the lockdown. It depended on your lifestyle and where you were and so on. So I think they realized that to keep their workforce happy, if they had one way, then, you know, potentially a quarter of their workforce would be happy and the other three quarters would be miserable. And therefore, they're now looking at ways in which they can create an environment in which they can serve all of the needs of their employees while still remaining consistent and fair and responsible as well to all of their stakeholders.
So should we feel optimistic that there is a more human era in the workplace emerging? I mean, this is what a lot of people are hoping for, is that it's a more understanding environment, one that can put people and, I guess, purpose first in terms of an order of priorities. Or do you think actually, you know, the leopard doesn't change its spots, that there is a, you know, that there is an element to which business is always going to be driven by the harder metrics of performance and profit, and often people pay the price for that.
No, I definitely think a change is going to come, as they say, that without a doubt, in order for organisations to remain relevant, they are going to have to change things. It's not an option. And actually, one of the things that was quite interesting about the pandemic was that the sort of seeking a purpose was something that was assumed to be relevant to the workforce of the future. And companies were trying to be proactive in preparing themselves to meet it, by having a purpose, by having sort of a vision that they could engage people with. What happened was, through the pandemic, actually a lot of people of every generation, the older generation, started to reassess what mattered to them. Mm. And now that sort of future need has become very current, very present. They need to be able to inspire people, their workforce today. And that range could range from a 23-year-old who's getting their first job all the way up to the 55-year-old who's on the boards, part of the C-suite. Everybody is seeking more than the transactional relationship of, you know, I show up, I do my work, I get paid, I leave.
And I suppose regrettably, Marion, we're almost out of time, but I suppose this brings us back to the search for meaning that human beings go through in their lives. We mentioned your mum's passing over the summer, and you said that my new normal is not having to worry about her anymore. And this combination of there is something liberating, but also something missing all of the time. Mm. In terms of, I suppose, we're now talking in the early autumn, in terms of what I feel I'm speaking to a person that continuously learns things about themselves and learns things because situationally their environment changes so often. In terms of what you have learned about yourself over this very recent time, and actually how it makes you feel about the future, what might you share?
I think that generosity has played a huge role in my life. I've been on the receiving end of it an awful lot, and I try to practice it whenever I can. And my mother was a particularly generous woman. And what I have taken away from her life, what, you know, the legacy that she's left me, is that there is always payback. There is, you know, if you show kindness and generosity and faith in people, I mean, you will get it back.
Circularity,
absolutely. And I think that's probably the thing that certainly, when I look at my mother's life and I think, well, what did she give me? I mean, a sense of humor as well, because my mum, like my father, did have a sense of humor and needed to, frankly. Because she had quite a difficult life. But yeah, I think those are the lessons that every single day I see it. I see how being generous, whether it's with your time or your kindness or your knowledge, whatever it is, you will always get it back tenfold. And that's the rule by which I hope that I live my life. It's certainly the philosophy that underpins the company that I've started. Everything, you know, we have a great big sign downstairs that says be generous. And everything that we do is geared towards going sort of beyond the call of duty. If I may very quickly give you one example of that. A little while ago, we were having an operations meeting on a Friday, and my mobile phone rang from somebody who I wouldn't normally expect to hear from sort of during working hours. So I apologized. I picked up the phone, and it was somebody saying that a friend of theirs had gone off the rails and his wife had tracked him down, and he was about to jump over a bridge, and they sort of caught him and brought him home and so on. And he didn't know what to do. Now, this was a case that was way beyond our pay grade. You know, somebody at that level of crisis, we would normally refer to an inpatient unit. So I put the phone down and I shared this with my colleagues. And it was like dropping a little bomb in the middle of all these sort of mice. They just all got up from their seats and everybody went into a different direction and picked up the phone. And within an hour, we had a series of solutions for this person. Amazing. And there was nothing in it for us. But I would say if I look back, in fact, tomorrow is our first birthday. If I look back on the last year and everything that we've achieved, that moment is the moment I'll take away with me.
Well, I have to say, Mariam, happy birthday on that. And thank you for sharing that. I mean, I have to say, you said at the beginning of this interview, try to learn a little about everything. Well, I think, you know, everything is that generosity of spirit. And I think throughout this interview, you've not only shown why, but you've been a great example of it. So Mariam Medin, thank you very much for joining me on Changemakers.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Changemakers is brought to you by the campaigns firm Seven Hills and presented by me, Michael Heyman. Pure Being is the name of our soundtrack and it's written and performed by the brilliant BT Wolf. To find out more, head over to changemakers.works and if you like what you hear, why not give us a rating?